Well, welcome again to everyone, and a special welcome to Michael Bernhack, not a new face within the School of Advanced Study or the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies, but this is your sort of formal seminar that you're giving within the Dean's seminar series. You're a visiting professorial fellow at the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies. Michael is, as you will know, professor in the University of Tel Aviv. His research area is on information law, which includes things very of very close interest to academics like copyright and data protection. But what he's going to be doing today is talking about things which really sit above the practicalities of copyright and so on, the theory of privacy overarching these sort of practical issues. Michael's going to talk to us for about 40, 45 minutes, after which we can have some questions and we'll try and wrap things up and have things go around about 1:45, 1:50, so that we can all get off to things that we may have starting at 2:00. There'll be opportunity at the end. There'll be some more sandwiches and coffee and stuff left. We've got some free time just to stop and talk informally. So, Michael, I invite you to give your paper and then we'll discuss it.
Thank you very much, Dean, for having me here, and thank you for the kind words and for having me here at the school. And it's been a pleasure the last year, and I'm sure it will be a pleasure next year, this year. So thank you all for coming over here, and please, if you do have clarification questions in the middle or something, so please do not shy. I do apologize. I will probably begin by saying privacy, but at some point, pretty quickly, I will be saying privacy. So I apologize for that if that is of any concern to you. What I would like to do is to propose that the best way to understand privacy is as a family of situations, that's a reference to Wittgenstein, of course, with a core, a theoretical core. And the theoretical core is privacy as a matter of control. Control, I mean our own control over our own information. This is not a matter of property, but of autonomy and human dignity. So in order to defend this claim, what I would like to do is first just alert ourselves to a few new technologies and then ask about the challenges to privacy today over here and in many other societies and jurisdictions as well. And then to delve into privacy theory to see what is privacy to the extent that we can figure out what it is and say something about it. So a few technologies. I guess some of you, if not all, have a Facebook account. I do not. So I see some others who do not share that, but obviously you have heard about it. Facebook recently once again changed its design and whatever it does there with the news feed showing up in a different way, and at least I've heard anecdotal evidence of people saying, whoa, what's going on here? I didn't know all this information was kept here, etc. This is just the last of Facebook's many privacy issues. Then we have Google. Google is supposedly a search engine, but in fact it is an advertisement company. Google has also failed in the issue in the area of privacy more than once. One of the most celebrated privacy scandals of Google was the Buzz, Google's previous attempt to have a social network. People found out that all their Gmail correspondents are their friends, including some business associates, ex-wife, husband, whatever, people that you do not necessarily want to be friends of anymore. Then we have body scanners. If you've recently been to the United States, you've either seen them or were processed, I don't know how exactly to say, were scanned by them. many people feel very uncomfortable with being seen naked without taking their clothes off. I guess they would be nervous also with taking their clothes off in public. There are some technological advances now. The figure is not necessarily the human, the actual human body, but more of a sketch or a stick figure. And if there's a gun or something hidden there, that's a gun. So it will show as a gun or as a strange object rather than the actual human figure. Google, once again, Street View. I guess you're all familiar with this. Google Street View has caught on its camera some interesting pictures every now and then. Not everyone would like him or her to be seen in this way. Google just last week started taking photography in my home country, in Jerusalem in this case. They had to design a special Google bike in order for it to go into the narrow alleys of the old city in Jerusalem. And there were pre-conditions that the government, the Ministry of Justice, set for Google in order to be allowed to take the Google Street View in the area, but soon you will be able to see all the holy places firsthand through Google's Street View bike. The cloud. You might have heard about cloud computing, which is something that all of you are doing, even if you do not know it's called cloud computing. The idea is simple. Computer resources are outsourced to a cloud. The data is not, or the activity is not necessarily done locally on a server which is located somewhere nearby, but it's out in the internet cloud, wherever it is. Perhaps more accessible to strangers whom we do not necessarily want them to access the data. CCTV, we are in London, need I say anything more about that? RFID tags. Quite likely, if you buy something in a shop towards the holiday season, Thanksgiving in the US, or Christmas, etc., over here and other holidays, quite likely the items you buy have an RFID tag in them. It's as small as you see, it's that small thing hidden often under a label or something like that. Quite likely, some of you have an RFID tag on your clothes right now. It doesn't necessarily mean anything, but if you enter a place which has an RFID reader, such as the same shop or chain in which you bought it, they might be able to identify whatever data they have on it. If you bought something with a credit card, that means quite a lot. Biometric. More and more we see the use of biometric identification, fingerprints of course, iris scans, and facial recognition in general. Here's a short research of which I've just heard a couple of weeks ago by Alessandro Acquisiti in Carnegie Mellon University in the United States. They stopped a few students on campus in the States, that's in Pittsburgh, asked them whether they are willing to participate in whatever research, asked them a few questions. As they were doing that, they took a photo of the person, logged on to a computer, a laptop which they had, which was connected, which was online. Through an algorithm they wrote, they were able to code the face to identify facial recognition elements, compare that to a Facebook database, which is quite accessible to, definitely to computer scientists, but to us as well. And by the time the two-minute questions to the person were done, which were bogus questions, just nonsense, they were able to address the person with his or her exact name and other details. Obviously, people were, whoa, how do you know that? I didn't say anything of that. But the government and other institutions use facial recognition more and more, and we will be seeing more of that in the coming years. Plate recognition. Technologies that are capable of reading the license plate of cars. Congestion fee uses that in many car parks, etc. GPS helps us hopefully to navigate, but also provides information to someone, such as your employer perhaps, about your whereabouts. In other words, your locational data.
Seafood wars.
That sounds like science fiction, but it's not. A technology that enables the use of that device, as you can see, to see if there's a human being behind a war. That obviously has, as the picture shows, some military applications, but it can also be used for civil issues, such as if someone is trapped after an earthquake or something of that that's a screenshot of The Guardian on my computer. You can't really see that, but there are the ads over here. All of you have the ads when you browse. We are quite, most of us are quite sort of fixed not to see what's going on there in the banner. Think of it. We don't even notice what's going on there. But do take a look the next time you surf, probably in a couple of hours or so. And check the, look at the ads. In this case, the ads are all related to Los Angeles. I am going to be there sometime soon, and I made some trip arrangements towards that. Not through The Guardian, but through other websites, emails, Gmail, etc. So, we have all these technologies. Some tracks behind the wall, you need that machine. All these technologies and many others are already in use, and there's a forecast of many more technologies of this kind. I'm part of a research group called Practice, which is somehow the acronym of what's written there. It's a European-based research group. What we're doing there is to forecast, that's not me, it's the other part of the team, to forecast future technologies in the range of 20 to 30 years' time that might have implications on our privacy and evaluate what's going on there. It's a bit of science fiction, but it's fun. And what we have there with the forecast of technologies is that it's pretty clear that we will just have more surveillance of various kinds, and it will be omnipresent everywhere. Not just in the street with a CCTV camera, but in many, many other situations, contexts, and location. There will be more data collected, not only about what we do, meaning where we are and whether we bought something or did some online activity, but about ourselves, things that it's quite difficult to control or change. Biometrics, facial recognition, etc., body temperature, heartbeat, that we will be able to be assessed from a distance without us, without someone coming on and, you know, measuring or whatever the technologies that we are familiar with today. So, in light of these privacy issues and the forecasted technologies, we have quite a few challenges that we should deal with as a society. Some of them are old challenges listed down there, and some of them are newer challenges. Please note that the technologies keep changing, and their related business models keeps changing. It's everything is in a flux. Everything is very dynamic, and it's very difficult to figure out what exactly we should do that. Add to that renewed or new, depends where you're coming from, interest in security, counterterrorism, etc., post 9/11, post 7/7 over here and other places. And the very issue of our changing perceptions of privacy. Now, I'm pretty sure that each of you has discussed with friends, family or colleagues, or, you know, in an unofficial sort of setting, privacy issues, even though, or not even though, and that is something new. Not discussing privacy of something else like Ryan Giggs or News of the World sort of scandals, but something related to us. Recall that, and I'm pretty sure that you have had this conversation maybe over Facebook, maybe over Gmail or other sort of technologies. Privacy becomes more of an issue, and more people are aware, excuse me, of privacy issues, But nevertheless, people seem to give their information for free without any limits and without any control. Facebook once again, and many other social networks in many other situations. I assume many of you have filled the form and gave information. So
I was just thinking.
So it might not be very private information, and it's someone we trust, the institution, the school, etc. Peter, of course. But we give information all the time without even thinking, oh, I just gave information.
But we're also required to give information which is not necessarily information we need to give as
right.
well.
Yeah.
The other one.
Of course. There are quite a few researchers about how many people read the privacy policies.
No.
The number is zero.
Mm. Not close to zero.
If it's not close to zero, you know, I know it's me. Or, you know, one of my colleagues, or occasionally someone else. And you know, people usually are drawn to the boxes which they should tick, and it's quite confusing. Over here, you have at least, usually you have two boxes. One is opt-in and one is opt-out, depending on the media of communication, whether it's physical letters or emails or phone. There's a different box for each. One is opt-in, one is opt-out. It's confusing. In the United States, they are less tolerable than that, and the options are often phrased in double negation. I do not agree that you will not do whatever, and that is confusing. There are cognitive issues there. It's confusing. You start thinking, oh, if I say I do not agree, then they will not, but does it mean that I do? It's confusing, and there will be another piece. So we have this so-called, in the literature, privacy paradox. People who discuss privacy are more aware of it. They say they want more privacy or better privacy, but nevertheless, they give information, seems, for free. Then we have some legal challenges. I know that this is not a legal audience, so some exceptions I know and guess. So I will be very brief about that. Lay people, meaning not lawyers, might expect that the law will have a definition of privacy. Privacy is so and so, and it shall be defended in this or that way. I'm unfamiliar with any definition of privacy in any legal instrument over here in the US or, in fact, elsewhere, neither in international legal instruments. There is a discussion and protection of privacy in various ways, but it is not defined, not in the positive. On some occasions, we might find expressions such as private life in the European Convention of Human Rights. Or the EU has a data protection directive which has a local implementation over here in the Data Protection Act. But it doesn't define what is privacy. Neither in the UK, there is no Privacy Protection Act of any sort. Privacy has been protected by the courts initially as a development of the breach of confidence tort, which has been stretched quite a bit, but in recent years we see a few judges and justices in the Supreme Court and elsewhere in the higher courts say that it's time to recognize a new common law-based tort of privacy independent of the breach of confidence with some inspiration from the Human Rights Act. In the United States, there's no definition of privacy. Courts have developed, some 40 years ago, a legal test to assess whether there's a privacy interest worthy of protection. And that legal test is whether the person whom we are discussing had a subjective, reasonable expectation. So, for example, if I call 999, the emergency service, what is my expectation about them giving the information to third parties, which are unrelated to the emergency service? For example, obviously, when someone calls an emergency number, they don't think about that. Okay, so they have no subjective issues about that. They're concerned about something else very urgent. Hence the objective element. What would the reasonable person, or something like that, would think? In some laws, we find negative definitions. The law says that one should not take a photograph in the privacy of one's home, or something very specific. But it's not a positive definition of what privacy is. It's negative what it is not. So, what do we do about this? We've seen, and we will go on seeing, that privacy is a very vague idea, term. It's an elusive concept. It depends on social norms, which in themselves keep changing. It depends on technology, which in itself keeps changing. So we have here something in a flux. What I would like to do now is to conceptualize this within a framework of law and technology, or law and information technology, and then go on and see some issues or some attempts to theorize privacy, concluding with the privacy as controller, as I mentioned earlier. This is a very simple and brilliant model suggested by an American law professor, Larry Lessig, some 12 years ago now. And it is brilliant because it is so simple. In the center, there's the regulated dot. That is some human activity which we are considering whether we should, and if so, how to regulate. And Lessig points that we have four factors, four kinds of regulatory forces that regulate that regulated dot. So we have the law, of course, in various ways. We have social norms, which determine whether something is can happen or not. Some things are just, you know, impolite, and if we attempt to do them, we will be scrutinized and condemned in a social way. There are market elements that limit or enable what we can do. If I am very rich, I can get a private room in a hospital, God forbid, or something like that. I can buy a bigger house with high fences, etc., etc., and have more privacy in taking this to our specific issue. And then we have architecture. Lessig took the idea from architecture, but when he says architecture, he actually means technology. He means code. Hence his very famous slogan or statement that code is law. What does that mean, code is law? There's quite a lot of interpretation going on to explain that. But one of the explanations relevant to what we are doing is that code, technology, regulates in terms of both enabling and limiting what we can do, no less than law. Usually we think of how to regulate something through, oh, let's have a law, let's amend the law if there is one, etc. But Lessig says, oh, let's pay attention to technology that enables or limits what we can do. I would like to refine this model just a tiny bit, but in a way that I hope is more helpful. What I do here is convert Lessig's model into a triangle. Under values, I combine the market and the social norms. These are all sort of values that a society might hold or not. And when I say values, I mean both ethical values such as human dignity, autonomy, freedom, equality, that kind of level of abstraction, but also social norms and political norms, for example, the society's choice of to have a free market, etc. Once we have this as a triangle, that's the purpose of that, we better see the interconnections or the interactions between the different elements. So we have a triangle, three sides, values, laws, and technology, and each of them interacts with the other. So let's quickly go over each of these sides to say a few things, and then we will be back to course. The law and technology side. It is often said, we often hear that the law lags behind technology. Technology is cutting edge, and the law is made very slowly, it's an ancient law in many cases, etc., etc. This might be true on occasion, but it assumes quite a narrow view of the law as a set of limited rules, part, rather than a more principled-based Dworkin view of the law. The relationship between law and technology are not just the law trying to catch up with technology, but I would argue, and I'm not the only one, many have argued so, that law and technology interact. They communicate, there's a dialogue, there's a dialectic sort of relationship going on there. On occasion, the law regulates technology. I do hope there's some law saying that this and those bombs cannot be made on in person. That's a regulation of technology. In the copyright area, DRM, digital rights management, for those who are familiar, it is regulated in many countries. Those are digital locks on copyrighted works. So if you break the lock, meaning you manage to download a YouTube video, which was streamed rather than a downloadable file, that is breaking some sort of DRM, and if you're in the US, you might get into trouble, and in some other countries. Indirect regulation, the law often intervenes with technology, not in a direct way of saying this can be done and this should not be done, but by providing incentives either to do or to refrain from doing something. On occasion, the technology responds to the law rather than vice versa. For example, many people think that when they surf at 2 a.m. in the privacy of their home with their private computer, they have privacy, which couldn't be more wrong than that. People learn the hard way that they can be traced and their identity unmasked. It happens both in quite undemocratic countries, Saudi Arabia, Iran, North Korea perhaps, China, but it also happens in places like the United States, United Kingdom, and any other democracy. People are unmasked for copyright infringement, for defamation on occasion, and for other allegedly wrong things that they do. Sometimes they are in fact responsible, and sometimes they are not. So there are technological responses offering various tools, some easier than others to use, that enable some anonymity. So there's a website called Anonymizer, and you go through Anonymizer, and you surf the web through Anonymizer, and it sort of masks your detail, hopefully. Obviously, we have to trust Anonymizer to do that. Then there's Tor, T-O-R, which is supposedly an acronym of Tor Anonymizing. That is a more sophisticated way to disguise one's identity. It has become, it has reached the front pages a bit, or second page, with the WikiLeaks issue last year. WikiLeaks used Tor to disguise their whereabouts and identities, etc. Sometimes the law and technology cooperate. Some PETs is privacy or privacy enhancing technologies. Some technologies offer, please use us and we will offer you more privacy. So Anonymizer and Tor are some specific kinds of PETs. But there are many other technologies that provide us with more privacy, or at least they claim to provide us with more privacy. Let's look at another side of the triangle, that of values and technology. Some people think and believe that technology develops out of thin air, and that technology has its own rules, and it develops in a way that is untouchable, that others cannot interfere other than the people engaging in that. For those interested, you can read Kevin Kelly's recent book. He's a high-tech sort of guy, American, which is called Information Wants to Be Free, or What Does Technology Want? What does technology want? And the idea is technology wants to be free and open, etc. But it assumes that technology is personified here. It assumes that technology has its own rules of the game which are untouchable. Under that view, some people think that technology is value neutral, that it is just a tool. The most famous slogan that expresses that is the NRA, the National Rifle Association in the United States. Their slogan is, guns do not kill, people do. meaning don't regulate guns, but do regulate what people do. So there's a prohibition to kill someone who is using a gun, but don't regulate guns. That's what they want to say about them. While that is true in some sense, guns do not have their own will to be able to kill someone, but the counterview is that guns do carry, do embed some values. What are these values? Sometimes it's very difficult to find out. How did these values get into the technology? Sometimes they were inserted by the designer, and sometimes it's a social construction, social construction of technology. We, as a society, come to figure out and treat a specific technology in a specific way, and many technologies have dual uses. So a gun can be used for terrible things, such as killing someone, unjustifiably if there's anything else, but it can also be used on occasion for self-defense or for law enforcement matters. A knife can be used to attack someone and rob and do terrible things, which is a bad value, obviously, but it can also be used as self-protection tool, or just to make a wonderful meal, wonderful dinner, whatever it is. So some technologies have more than one social meaning, and the internet as such is exactly of a dual-use kind. The internet, as we know, enables us to do wonderful things in personal, social, political, economic, and whatever you wish fields. But at the same time, there are some bad people who use the internet in bad ways to defame, infringe, copyright, etc., etc. We know about that. The third side of the triangle, values and law. This is a field where jurisprudence enters into the picture, figuring out what is the meaning of the law, how should we interpret the law. There are various theories of interpretation. Those of you familiar with literature theory, interpretations, there are lots of parallels there, etc. More specifically, as to privacy, there's one way to interpret a law, to apply a law. You read the law and you say what it says and you apply it. As simple as that. But as lawyers know, and common sense, I guess, too, should be otherwise. Common sense people know that lawyers take some time. When the law says something, it still requires interpretation. More specifically about privacy, when we have a privacy-related law which protects privacy in some way or another, it often requires further interpretation. Recall one of the previous slides where it says in the ECHR, the European Convention of Human Rights, where it says that private life shall be protected. What is private life? So my physical, one's health situation, sexual life, etc., private life, sounds like private life to me. Biometrics, is that private life? I don't know. It really begins to stretch the definition in ways that require interpretation. Hence we need a theory, something that will help us to find our way in this mysterious legal, so social, technological, changing world that we live in. We need a theory that will explain what's going on in the best light, walking, and we also need a theory that will be able to instruct us as society policymakers what to do and what to do in the best way, especially if we want to plan ahead towards the forthcoming technologies. Over the years, there have been quite a few attempts to explain what privacy is as a legal matter. The first and by far the most important one is a definition by Warren and Brandeis, two American lawyers. Brandeis later became a Supreme Court Justice in the United States, a very famous one. They wrote an article which is the most quoted law review article in the United States in any field, not just in privacy, in any field. It was published in the fourth volume of the Harvard Review in 1890. Their stated motivation in the article was new technology. instant photography. It became possible towards the late 19th century to take instant photographs of not as good quality, I guess, as we have today in our mobiles, but pretty good technology. And gossip, newspapers. Newspapers more and more published sensational stories, often with the pictures associated. That was a new business practice at the time. The story is, which is not stated in the King Dare article, is that Warren had some party in his backyard for his daughter or niece, or some disputes about who exactly it was, but there was some party and it was reported in the newspaper. Just the fact that there was a party. And that was unheard of. Warren thought that only two kinds of people are mentioned in newspapers, criminals and politicians. And some would argue that it's only one kind of people. Their methodology was extraordinarily brilliant. What they did is they looked around into various legal fields and they said, okay, let's look at copyright of unpublished works. Let's look at property law. Let's look at this in various other fields. Each of them has its logic, has its interests to protect, to achieve, etc. But when we place all of them on the table, we see one interest, social interest, which keeps popping up in every one of them. And all we are doing, it is sort of, you know, we are not claiming to do anything more. All we are doing, they said, they wrote, was to identify this repeat interest which keeps appearing in various places and call it by a name, the right to privacy. And then they provided a definition, the right to be let alone. No explanations, no justifications, no underlying theory. Okay, it's just a very technical way of legalizing, of doing law. We look around, we spot something, we call it by a name. In fact, what they did was to create a legal right of privacy. There was privacy beforehand as a social norm, more or less in various societies, and it keeps changing, it varies from one society to another, etc. But they were the first to create a law that says privacy is a right. Privacy is not mentioned in the American Constitution. And now there's a question. If the response to the article was, if you say that privacy keeps appearing in all these places, so why do we need to call it a name? It is already protected by the law. If, on the other hand, you claim that there's something more in privacy, an added value, so you have to point and show that it is an added value and defend it, explain why we need to protect it. Maybe it's just something we do not, as a society, wish to protect or interested in protecting. 70 years later, Dean William Grosser did a similar technical job, which was not technical at all. He gathered all the cases, American cases, there were quite a few by then, that mentioned privacy in the 70 years in between the two articles. And then he classified them. And he classified them into four groups, kinds, clusters. And these are listed here. Intrusion upon seclusion, appropriation of name or likeness, public disclosure of private facts. That's the Warren and Brandeis idea of the right to be let alone. And false light. False light is not defamation, it's something slightly less than defamation. For example, if I say that a person voted for party A, which is in fact wrong, that person voted for party B, that is quite likely not defamation, because both parties are legitimate, they are legal, etc. But it might be false light, it might be a wrong fact which presents the person in a false light. Now, these are interesting clusters of torts, but think of some of the technologies that we saw at the beginning of the discussion. Body scans. Where does that fit in? CCTV. Facebook gathering and spreading information. Where does that fit in? Intrusion upon seclusion. Maybe if we somewhat stretch what seclusion is. Public disclosure of private facts. Facebook users disclose their facts on their own, but only to some kinds of people. some of them block their information, some of them don't, etc. In other words, the definitions might have been helpful for a while, but they can no longer explain or help us classify new things into the to this framework. Two other definitions, very powerful definitions in the literature. One by American sociologist Alan Westin, and the other by Israeli Hebrew University of Jerusalem Professor Ruth Gavison. Last year I had the honor and the chance to chair a panel of these two eminent scholars. It was an international conference in Jerusalem. Alan Westin, as a sociologist, defined privacy. And he says that it's the claims of individual groups or institutions, the institution parts is a bit of a difficult item there, to determine for themselves when, how, and to what extent information about them is communicated to others. In other words, Westin assumes a person, a human being, and institution and groups, which control what goes outside, what goes from the inside, from that unit, outside. Gavison's description, which is, she claims it to be sociological in the sense that it's a bottom-up sort of discussion rather than a top-down theory, which is known in the literature as privacy as access, controls the other direction. It identifies the same unit, the same person, but it says we should control who has access to the person, from the inside, from the outside towards inside. No, it sounds the same, right? It sounds like two sides of the same coin. Why does it matter whether the information goes outside or inside? There's a bubble there. There's something that controls the person. In fact, Gavison argued recently in that conference that our theories are actually the same. No, they are not. There's a huge difference whether I am to control what goes outside and what as one option, as opposed to whether I have control who has access to me, which means I have far less control over some issues. It hopefully will be clearer later on. Then we have another way to understand privacy, and that is to classify it into areas of operation, if you wish. Privacy in places. We think that a man's and woman's castle, a man's and woman's home is their castle. I was confused by that one. But our privacy is not limited to the home. We expect to have privacy also when we are in a shop, in a fitting room, or in the gym, or in the bathroom, or in many other situations, hospital, etc., etc. The inside-outside lines are often blurred. If you happen to be a, I assume, rich enough to own one of the flats, or just behind the Tate Modern, there's a new building there with huge windows. You can see everything that goes inside. If you live there, you might be very rich and very happy about your location, but as a matter of fact, while you're inside, you have pretty little privacy unless you take an extra measure, a technology called a curtain or something like that. So, privacy in communications. We expect to have privacy in our phone conversations, posts, emails, etc. But we need to trust a third party, post office, the telecom company, BT, etc., and the ISP, and the internet service provider. We need to trust them. Sometimes they're trustworthy, and sometimes, apparently, they are less trustworthy than we think. There's an interesting distinction between the information on the outside of the envelope and the inside. And there used to be this hierarchy of the content being far more important than what's on the outside, because the outside is instrumental. It is used by the post to deliver the letters. Online, this distinction totally collapses. Think of a subject line of an email, which might be extremely informative. Sometimes the envelope data is far more important than the content. For example, if I work at a certain organization and I send an email to a recruiting firm and the line is my CV attached, nobody needs to know what's the content. It's obvious what the content is. I'm looking for a new job. my employer might be interested in such an information. A journalist who communicates with his or her sources. The content is unimportant because the content is in the newspaper. You can read, what's important is the very fact that someone communicated with someone else and exactly who and when, etc. The Americans have another category of decisional privacy. Decisional privacy means a person's autonomy. The very famous Roe v. Wade decision about abortions is based legally, the explaining principle there is privacy. A woman has a privacy to make a decision to, etc., etc. In other places, we would not frame this issue as a matter of privacy, but as autonomy, human dignity, and debate whatever people debate. Informational privacy, or in European parlance, data protection. This is probably the most important category in modern or postmodern times. There's a difference between the way that the Americans protect informational privacy and the way that the European Union protects it. In short, in the US you have far less privacy than you have in the European Union, at least according to the law in the books. In practice, it's changing. The Americans protect privacy in information only in very specific issues, such as health, finance, student grades. The professors among you or the students among you who might have applied to an American institution, on the recommendation form, the applicant is asked politely to check a box saying, I waive my right to see this recommendation. It's a matter of a specific privacy law, and they just gave up their rights. If they don't, obviously the recommendation is worth less than it is if it's purely anonymous. Encourage your students who apply to American institutions to check that box, even though they give up their privacy if they want to be students there. That's what they have to do. The EU has a very detailed legal construct of data protection with a directive, and member states have their law. The key construct there is personal data. Personal data is not defined according to the content of the data, but according to the criterion of identification, whether the data enables us to identify the person, whether the person is immediately identified or it is identified. It's a much more tricky but more sophisticated concept. Perhaps we can understand privacy better if we know what the threats are. So we have one threat is the government. That's a classical Big Brother threat. A newer threat is the market. More and more we realize that little system is not so little. Corporations gather information, trade that information, and they use the information about us without us even realizing that. Then we have situations, more and more so, in which the government and the market cooperate. My colleague Neva Elkin-Corin and myself, we published a paper I think 8 or 9 years ago, I'm not quite sure. It was a post-September 11 sort of discussion about the invisible handshake. Governments and private corporations more and more cooperate in ways that bypass constitutional and other legal guarantees. There's the media. It's quite a well-known threat to privacy, especially if you are in gigs or one of those celebrities. But then we have some new privacy threats. Our peers, our friends, capital F as in Facebook, our friends, they reveal information about us. They post our photos. They tag our photos with our names. We do the same to them and to ourselves. That's if you're on Facebook, if you're not so.
If you're not on Facebook, that can happen to you.
That you can be tagged. But
I had somebody take a photograph when I was carrying me to home at a dinner party. And he started putting it on Facebook tonight. I said, no, you won't, you haven't got my permission to do so. And I meant it in not just in jest, but seriously. I mean, this is a significant problem, as you obviously.
So we have new threats, and especially the last two, which Jonathan Zittrain calls Privacy 2.0, are new threats, and we are unequipped, not only legally, but socially and perhaps philosophically to deal with them. In view of what's going on here, there have been a couple of attempts recently, a bottom-up attempt inspired by Gavison in 1980. One of them is Daniel Sullivan, an American professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He provided a detailed taxonomy, 16 situations which relate to privacy. So it's a very nice sort of exercise. Let's think of body scanners. Where does body scanners fit in? Oh, it fits in into 2, 5, and 6, whatever. It might be helpful to figure out what's going on. It's a descriptive matter. It has no normative value, and we can debate. Why did you include number 12, blackmail, here? Maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe something else should be, etc., etc. But it lacks any normative value. A more interesting recent approach is Helen Nissenbaum. And those interested in that, I encourage you to read a book, Privacy in Context. Right? Helen Nissenbaum is a professor, she's a philosopher, and she's a professor of technology at the media department at NYU in New York. She discusses contexts and says that each context, social context, has its informational norms. And when new technologies or business models are introduced, these informational norms of the specific context are shaken, they are challenged. She asks us to compare before and after sort of comparison, in terms of comparing the information norms in the context before and after, and if she identifies a change, a delta, well, that's a prima facie violation of privacy. Then she said, okay, now we need to evaluate this change to see whether it's okay or not. How do we do that? Either we judge that according to the context's norms, so we have some social norms about the educational setting, or the health care setting, etc., etc., or external norms. It does help in understanding what's going on when we have a new technology. Before the talk, the gentleman over here mentioned, I know them as green boxes, but technologies that are installed in cars and are supposed to alert the driver about what he or she are doing wrong, speeding, or taking a too sharp curve or whatever, but the data is also collected and can be transferred to third parties, such as the parent, if it's his or her child, to an employer, to an insurance company. Next time you want to renew your insurance, oh, you're a bad driver, whoops, you have to pay more, etc. So we can evaluate such a new technology based on the context of. But there are quite a few issues with that. What exactly is a context? How do we define a new context? What is the context of Facebook? I don't know. As a sociological matter, I'm not a sociologist, but I have no idea. What about merging contexts? What about cases where we have no context? The practice of data mining is to take lots of data from different contexts, mix them and mine them to figure out something which we haven't seen before, metadata, data about data. I do believe that we need an external measure. So we get to privacy justifications, and I will go faster here, so to leave some time. These are the family of justifications which share a common core. That's my argument, that this is the best way to understand privacy. The common core is not mine, it's Western's. It's privacy as control. But I think it's at the core of these concentric circles, if you wish, a different metaphor of family resemblance between different situations. Wittgenstein, you're most welcome to use that. So, I would like to draw that as a family of concentric circles, the person right there in the middle. But there are other circles as well. We enjoy human dignity. So says Article 1 of the German Constitution. So says some other constitutions around the world, and so says Immanuel Kant. We have, furthermore, other than the philosophical understanding of what a person is, we have some psychological needs. sometimes we want to be alone. Alone is not necessarily something physical. Alone is leave me alone. So I want my privacy. Mind your own business. Not to be interfered. Why do we need that? For a variety of reasons. When we are 15 or 16, we are busy figuring out who we are in the world and what is the purpose, the meaning of life, and that sort of stuff. Some of us keep asking these questions later on as well. We need a backstage. We need a kitchen. Somewhere where we can contemplate. Somewhere where we can try, figure out things, experiment, without a scrutinizing gaze, without someone looking at us, staring at us, and saying, you know, and conveying a message of, you should not do this or that. There's a neighbor down the road here, Jeremy Bentham, kept it in a closet. You can go and take a look at that. For those of you who haven't seen him, it's a bit bizarre, but he's over there. Bentham came up with the idea of the Panopticon, a design for a prison. So it's a circle building. The prisoners' cells are, if you can see, over here, with three sides facing the center. They have today, we would say, Venetian blinds. Thank you. Or one side mirror, or one of those things. They can be watched from the center, and the center is where the guards are in the tower. But the brilliant thing was that the prisoners do not know whether they are being watched or not at any given moment. Hence, they internalize the idea of, oh, I'm being watched. And when I'm being watched, I might behave differently. When it comes to prisoners, it might be a good idea. When it comes to non-prisoners, free people, you might have some different views about that. The second circle. Privacy is important for the development and nourishment of some relationships, intimate relationships with our family, spouses, etc. But also professional relationships with our lawyer, accountant perhaps, with our rabbi and priest or that sort of relationship. In the absence of privacy, there will be less intimacy, if at all. Some couples choose to be, you know, to have a press conference while lying in bed, right? But that's the unusual occasion. On the community side, there's much criticism on privacy by communitarians. The most vocal is Professor Amita Etzioni, an American sociologist. But for those interested in this subject, Etzioni has a background as a member of a kibbutz in then Palestine in 1947. And then he emigrated to the United States and stayed over there. I believe that experience explains much of his communitarian views. Etzioni says, privacy? You mean limit society's, the community's ability to know that the driver of the school bus has this and that background? Of course I would like to know that background. So he gives up his privacy, the best trade-off that I've heard of in the last century. That's the phrase that he really likes. And he's willing to trade off privacy for the sake of community. But privacy can contribute to the well-functioning of community. Otherwise, it's a TMI. TMI is too much information. Sometimes, when we know things about our neighbors, we say, oh, I don't want to know that. And we really mean that. I don't want to know this and that about my neighbor. Sometimes, bliss ignorance of some sort, right, helps us communicate with other people, not knowing what's going on behind the facade. On the state level, privacy is important when we vote. That's a very specific occasion, but a crucial one in democracy, democratic theories. Privacy is important because it represents the freedom that we have, or should have, as citizens in democracies. When we think of non-democratic countries, non-democratic times, one of the first things that we think of is not having privacy. We think of the KGB or the Stasi or Securitate in Romania or wherever. These are, privacy is often taken, and for a reason, as a hallmark of democracy. And concluding views. Privacy is controlled. Let's go back to Westin's definition, which is in front of you. I believe that it best captures various situations, all of Lissenbaum's contexts, which he examines, the categories, privacy in places, in communication, etc., all fit in into this matter of control. It perfectly fits in with the normative justifications, with the understanding of the person as an autonomous agent, being able to decide for himself or herself what to do. Human dignity in the most Kantian way you can think of. Privacy is often, or the control is often, or sometimes ridiculed and discussed as a matter of property. Some American lawyers have done that, law scholars. That is wrong. There's no reason to think about one human right in terms of the concept of another concept, whether private property is a human right or not. I'm unsure of that. Even if it is, it's unwise to think about one field in terms of the other if they are taken to be on some horizontal level. If anything, we should ask about their the more abstract value from which they both derive, human dignity, etc., in that case. So there's no reason to equate controlling the privacy area to property. And that is the response. Privacy is often, or control is often, ridiculed and explained as a matter of secrecy. No, it is not. I can be a fully functioning human being agent and with 100% control over the information about myself, but nevertheless, I, understanding, informed consent, I provide data. I have a Facebook or an email account in Gmail and I search, etc. If I understand what I'm doing, if I do that willingly, if I have a choice, and a meaningful choice, not a confusing choice about ticking a box, which nobody really reads and you can't really understand what's written there. If I have a real choice, then I am in control of myself in this sense, even though I've just given up my entire life to that. Some concluding thoughts are written over there and some further reading which is listed. I apologize for taking more time than I should have. Sorry.
Michael, please don't apologize. That's absolutely a fascinating talk and astoundingly clearly presented. You said at the beginning that you're going to be talking about this continuous search for a theory of privacy, but my sense is from what you've said that this search in an academic sense is on a steep and upward trajectory. Now, presumably, that is driven by the fact that we are at the moment at the time of incredible technological change in this whole area. By comparison with our social human values, which are relatively slow to change, law, which is perhaps even slower to change than that. So, is this as in an academic sense, is this simply a response to these technologies, or if you go back even to your 19th century example, Warren and Brandis, you know, that was when new photos technology was coming in, newspapers were coming in. Is this a technological driven inevitability?
I guess so, and it will only become worse in that sense.
Well,
there will be more technologies than we will be, or our children and grandchildren, etc., will be more frustrated than we are.
Is there a counter technology which will be?
It's often said that the answer to the machine is the machine.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's true. Think once again about the body scanners. You can design body scanner. No, I can't design it, but whoever designs it could have designed it as they did initially, which actually shows the human figure. But it can just show, you know, sort of a stick figure of, oh, you have something, a strange object on your leg. Oh, that's a gun. Oh, we have a few questions to ask them, you know, etc. So that's an example of a technology which could be designed in multiple ways. It was first designed in one way, and then there was some outcry, etc., and some designers said, oh, perhaps we can do it a different way. So the answer to the machine might be the machine.
Yeah.
But I do think that we should engage in this search for theory, because first it can help us understand what's going on better,
absolutely,
perhaps, and it can hopefully it can guide us. That the immediate trigger, I've been thinking of this for quite a while, but the immediate trigger was Helen Nisimova's book. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant book, a fascinating read. She's a philosopher, and she understands technology. She also works with some people at NYU Law School, so such as she knows, she's not a lawyer, but she knows the law about that, etc. And she gave up. Having a bottom-up sociological account is wonderful because it does help explain many things that previously we were with some pains to explain. But it's giving up on the normative side. It's giving up on the instructive side. And as a lawyer, I'm often interested in, okay, what should we do about it? And we can either say we should do nothing, let the market deal with that, maybe there will be a counter technology that will answer, and there's no need for intervention. And sometimes, yes, we do want to intervene as a matter of law, and, but nevertheless, you know, the law can come in all sizes and shapes. So a better understanding might help us understand what to do. If we understand privacy as a matter of control in the way that Weston explained, and I suggest that we go back to that,
yeah.
We can focus on issues of control. When I am in the car and that device is installed, do I have control? Can I switch it off? Do I know that the machine gathers information and that is transferred to third parties and who they are, etc.? Can I make decisions about it? Okay, I have no problem that my family will see this, but I don't want my insurance company to see it, etc., etc. If we design, if we have a better understanding, we can translate that into law and into design. There's an interesting discussion going on in the privacy area about privacy by design, PBD, which means exactly the body scanners issue. Think about it ex ante of the privacy implications and design the technology to begin with, that it will collect less data, that it will not have an image but only a stick figure or some generic sort of human figure, and avoid many of the issues in advance.
Colleagues, comments and questions for Michael, please.
I'm not sure I've understood why the distinction between access and control matters, and if there is such a distinction, I was wondering, does in this taxonomy by Solow, so would A, B, and D correspond to access and C to control? Is that?
Let's focus on this, and I believe it. We can play with Solow's taxonomy and ask, Where does it fit? Which captures more? Does Westin and Solow's actually more or less the same? Or perhaps Garrison's, etc. But the difference is between Westin and Garrison, as far as I understand it, Garrison thinks there's no distinction anymore, but there is. I think there is. I think Westin also thought there is, but it was correct. But that's my interpretation of his judgment. One distinction is the way I portrayed it, is the direction of the flow of information. Under Westing, the direction is begins with the person who goes outside. Hence the control vests initially with me, and if we think it's a good thing, we should make sure that the person has the control. Gavison is interested only in the borders, and the direction of the flow of information is to be blocked. So some intrusions are blocked, and intrusion benefits with some of William Cross's classification, and perhaps with the right to be let alone of Warren Brandeis, etc. There are overlaps between theories, no doubt about it. But once she is interested only in the outside-inside direction, she identifies and focuses on three situations. She mentioned these in her article. It's a Yale Law Journal paper, considered a classic article in the privacy theory. And she says that she identifies these three situations: secrecy, anonymity, and solitude. Now, I agree that these are very important issues, but why these three? Perhaps anonymity is not part of it. Why is anonymity a matter of access to the person? Oh, because if they know who I am, they're okay, I understand. Maybe something else should be there. She doesn't provide any explanation. She just says it's sort of an intuitive sort of thing. Now, the differences, other than this, it might seem an abstract sort of difference, but they boil down to real issues. For example, anonymity. An online, think once again about an online user who is absolutely positive that he or she are anonymous online when they post a comment to a story on The Guardian, or when they tweet something not under their real name but under some other name, a pseudonym, nickname. They think they have anonymity and then they realize that they do not. Okay, because the police or someone knocks on the door, or someone sues them, or whatever it is, or they are just exposed for. George Michael was one of the those who tweeted on the Ryan Giggs affair. That's all he was exposed for tweeting on that. So, anagarism, anonymity is a matter of privacy. And now perhaps we can balance that, perhaps we need to balance that with other issues and trade-off, etc., etc. But her starting point is that anonymity is protected. And the Western, it's not quite clear that anonymity is protected, because it's not a matter of control. I might walk down outside Universal Square and have a mask, but a friend of mine might walk by and say, oh, that's my home. So I tried to be anonymous, but I didn't succeed. I was identified, and it happens, you know, it can happen all the time. So it's not quite clear that I can, as a physical, technical matter, that I can control my identity. We have to come up with an argument, and I believe there is one, to show why anonymity is also a matter of privacy as a matter of control. So these different directions of who has control over what. It's me over the information that goes out, or some barrier around me that blocks others, but does not necessarily limit what goes outside. Perhaps some biological metaphors about diffusion, I'm not too interested in that field, can be better to explain what goes inside and outside, etc.
Please.
I'm trying to understand whether all these issues are scalable. That is, you tend in your examples to locate the individual at the center of that radiating set of circles. George Eliot does the same thing with her theory of ethics in the 19th century, which she gets out of Kant and others. But I have real problems because, you know, if my daughter happens to, you know, email her boyfriend a picture of herself undressed, that's one kind of thing. If a government claims a kind of privacy for their policies that those who are affected cannot investigate in any way, it's really, it seems to me, a hugely different issue. And I'm wondering, have people talked about scalability and where there are differential points in the way you have to reason? Because I think the consequences, at least, of privacy protections are very different, even in the question of inside or outside. I would wonder about that. I would think that governments need kind of transparency that would allow outside people to come in, and that's a different issue from anonymity.
Yeah. So I would respond both from an internal privacy sort of point of view and an external one. Internally, if we take these circles as a metaphor to understand what's going on, the government doesn't fit in here. It's not a person, it's not a relationship, it's not a community. It is the state, but privacy is not important for itself to handle its own doing. Sometimes the government might be interested in having things done secretly because a military operation or whatever. In Israel yesterday, it was revealed that there's going to be a major prisoners swap, one soldier exchanged for over 1,000 prisoners on the other side. These discussions were kept in private, where they were secret. If they were not kept done in secret, probably they would not have happened, and all of these people would have remained in prison. So the state might have an interest in having things secret in some situations, but it's not an interest in prison. It's an interest of security, of well-functioning, of something specific, yes or no, and we can debate whether it's correct, whether or not that is justified or not. And we do have a principle which derives from cult theories of representation and sovereignty. Who's the sovereign in the democratic country? It's the people, it's not the government, which require transparency. And in most democracies we have transparency, more or less, and when it's not, so we have courts and freedom of information requests, etc. So on the first level, I would argue, internally, the government, as opposed to the state as a setting, the government is not in this picture and does not have privacy rights at all. It might have an interest in secrecy and specific issues, but we have countervailing issues and we deal with that in constitutional law, administrative law, etc. From an external point of view, even if a person, a relationship, a community or a state, in the community sort of state, functioning of the state, has privacy rights, it's not the end of the story. These, in justified cases, can be traded off and can be balanced. Criminal law does that all the time. Criminal law, when the police has the duty, not only the right and the public interest and the empowerment, but they have the duty to enter into a suspect's home and to arrest him or her, because otherwise, whatever. If that is done according to law and is justified in a democratic country and is proportional, and these are not my terms, these are terms of the European Convention of Human Rights and many other legal instruments which require these seemingly procedural but actually substantial guarantees of freedom, that's a mechanism to balance. And that raises a whole lot of other questions. What is proportional? What is not proportional? Who makes the decision? The government or the ex ante? Yes. Or the court exposed, which might be too late in some cases. How do we compensate when the government is found to have acted wrong, etc., etc.? So I hope that answers some of the
questions. Would you have a further
Well, two more quick points.
With regard to, is there any theory that differentiates the theory of privacy between, say, adults and minors or children, or is it all much of the same thing?
I don't know if there are theories, but there is growing empirical literature about children's privacy. Etienne, whom I mentioned earlier, in a different context of defamation and online pornography, etc., says we should not, as a sociologist, he says, we should not treat minors, as the law does, as one category. It's not 0 to 18, 17 or 21, depends which country, and then all the rest. Within the minor group, it's a different story. If it's a 10-year-old exposed to whatever online, or a 17-year-old exposed to whatever. And there are first empirical research of this kind over the last 2 years, I would say, maybe 3 years, mostly in the United States, but elsewhere as well. If interested, Dana Boyd is a very celebrated scholar who did some research about privacy in this case. There's an empirical research on privacy of minors and children on the various ages by Akiziti of Carnegie Mellon, whom I mentioned, Ryan Carlo of Stanford, and Chris Hufnagel from Berkeley, who studied what children want about privacy. And it turns out that even though they say everything online, on Facebook, etc., they want more or less what we adults want. They just do it differently. They do it in their way, and they understand a bit less, but they're not as stupid as we older people tend to think. There's a major European research going on with an LSE branch about children's online behavior in Europe, etc., which also, I don't think they look into privacy, but it has privacy implications. And in the practice project, which I mentioned earlier, we have conducted surveys among school 15, 16, 17 year olds in six European countries plus Israel to study that. So there's growing literature which is mostly empirical, sociological in nature. There's one article by Blechel and associates, whose name I forgot, about the privacy between parents and children, which is, for example, about a daughter and some other issues which, you know, to what extent can a parent spy after he's a child, you know, because we are told that it might be a good idea to spot whether they use illegal substance or
my fellow colleagues, I think we better just draw the formal procedure to a close at the moment, so we are close on to 2 o'clock. You know, this is a fiendishly complex area, and you've told us a bit about some of the academics and others who've been producing models to try to reveal some of the underlying dimensions to that complexity, but I think probably none of them actually approaches what I will now call, I think, the Bernhardt triangle, where you've got technology and values and law at the apexes. And that did seem to me to encapsulate, you know, the really underlying issues. Now you're going to say that this is not something you subscribe to anymore.
I do, but it's a tiny adjustment to this.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's the nature of academic endeavour, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we go along in the process of iteration and gradually get to the truth. The theory of privacy we do not yet have, but we're on the way. Yeah. Thank you very much, Michael, for what I did.